Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following is an excerpt from a 1992 BBC documentary. Take a listen.
My daughter had gone on holiday with her boyfriend, and 5 days into their holiday on the 2nd of August, they were killed in the Bologna train bombing explosion. And they managed to identify Catherine's body later on Monday, but she was horribly disfigured. They only recognised her by Miss Southridge's blaze.
In 1980, a bomb exploded at Bologna railway station, which killed 86 people. 6 years later, an official report revealed the existence of an invisible government in Italy, run by the state secret services and groups of political terrorists. It also identified a secret military and civilian organization under which neo-fascist groups were allowed to commit atrocities against civilians for political motives.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined by
Vincent Caldoni.
And this week we've got another cool story for you. We're going to talk about a super secret Cold War project that spawned a lot of discussion and conspiracy theories, believe it or not. Some of these theories may or may not be true, but we're going to talk about. And of course, you may have already guessed we're talking about Operation Gladio.
I'm going to give you guys a lot of credit if you guessed it just from that.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's true. There are a lot of Cold War projects out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. First off, a little clarification here. Operation Gladio actually technically only refers to an Italian organization. But there are a lot of other organizations like the Italian one across Europe, somewhere around 15 or so, I think. Mm-hmm. And they've all wound up being grouped under the same heading by the media and called Gladio. And that's a popular reference that you usually hear out there if you know anything about this story. And so that's the one we're going to be using here for the most part. But it's not, technically not completely accurate.
These organizations, of which Gladio that you just described was one, they were called Stay Behind Networks. And they were essentially intelligence and resistance networks set up in friendly countries so that in the event of an invasion or an occupation by the Soviets, there would already be a network in place. Makes sense. That's sensible, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's proactive. I like it.
Exactly.
It's a good idea.
Getting out in front of it.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to infiltrate your own country when your government controls it rather than waiting until it's under the enemy's control, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
I think so. The genesis of the idea seems to have come from another stay-behind network from World War II. Hmm. This was kind of an inadvertent one, actually. It's kind of cool. In the wake of the German invasion and occupation of northern France, hundreds of thousands of British soldiers were left stranded in and around the town of Dunkirk, France, right there on the English Channel, Nolan movie.
Yeah, the name might be familiar to me. That's a good movie, by the way. I recommend it.
I dug it. Yeah. And of course, most of you know that story, but for those who don't, here's what happened.
Yeah.
The British government just didn't have the resources to evacuate its soldiers, so the call went out for ordinary citizenry to step in. Thousands of Brits jumped into their fishing boats, yachts, or whatever they had, and they sailed across the channel to pick up soldiers and bring them home. It was a resounding success, and it's an inspiring story, really.
It is. It's awesome. Yeah.
And all of the soldiers, well, nearly all of them, but like 300,000 of them were rescued.
Yeah, 300,000. But yeah, actually not quite all of them got out. Around 6,000 soldiers were left behind, stranded in northern France in enemy territory. These guys all went into hiding and they tried to find their way home in the following months. And of course, there was the quickest way was just to go straight north, a short hop. But unfortunately, that was blocked. The Germans had that under especially intense lockdown. So they succeeded by traveling south. They would sneak into across the border into Vichy, France, the part that was not occupied by the Germans, and then further south. Some would go to Marseille and were smuggled onto ships, but most of them crossed into Spain and made their way to Gibraltar, and hence back home to freedom. But a few decided not to leave. These were the original stay-behind agents, and who knows, maybe the inspiration for this idea. These soldiers stayed on and at great risk to themselves set up networks composed mostly of friendly French civilians. And they created what were called escape lines for the trapped soldiers. Plus for all the pilots and airmen who were getting shot down over northern France all the time. It's a very fascinating story. And in fact, I intend to delve into this tale a little bit more deeply in a future episode.
Yeah, you should.
I've got a story saved up for you, actually. It's on my list. But anyway.
The British government set up an intelligence directorate to fund and help the escape lines. It was called the MI9, and it was under control of MI6. After the war, MI6 helped to create the first stay-behind network in France around 1946. Presumably, many of their recruits came from the escape line networks.
That would make sense. These are obviously vetted, reliable people.
And you'll notice I'm being a little vague here. Just about all of the records of these secret organizations have been destroyed. So precise dates and numbers are kind of hard to come by.
Yeah. But other nations followed along with this idea. The West German network was begun in about 1948. More countries set up these networks in the early 1950s. You got to remember, this may seem nuts to you now, but during the Cold War, this was an especially paranoid time. I mean,
yeah,
we honestly expected the Soviets to invade Europe.
Yeah.
And they had already taken over about half of Europe. And so it was not really out of the realm of possibility that they would go ahead and take the rest of it.
Yeah.
So, but these networks are being set up, again, all across Western Europe. And the size and the character of these organizations varied between countries. One of the better documented networks was in the Netherlands, where there were, it's estimated between 100 and 200 stay-behind agents. And there again, we're being vague because, but they had at least 100 agents. And each cell was composed of two men, at least initially. There was an organizer and an operator. The organizer's job was to recruit other agents into his network. People who, of course, you know, were trustworthy and also who could do the network some good. The operator, on the other hand, would serve as a liaison between the organizer and the brass upstairs. And of course, each of these cells had no knowledge of any other cells. That's key, too. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So they can't be tortured out of them.
Exactly. And as for the agents that were recruited by these organizers, we actually have no idea how many of those there were. It is interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, caches of supplies and weapons were squirreled away all across Europe. Guns were easily acquired since there were tons of surplus rifles and pistols floating around at the time. Explosives were supposedly supplied by the U.S. government, though I'm not sure why, because you would think they had plenty of, you know, explosives closer to home.
Yeah, the Europeans know how to make explosives just as good as we do, I think.
Yeah, I don't know, but America likes getting involved in stuff like this, so
yeah,
whatever.
That's true. We like our booms. Yeah, that's true.
Something to do. Yeah. the CIA supplied specialized radio gear, which probably was pretty helpful, because I believe the CIA had some pretty high-tech stuff for that time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Radio Shack gear. No, I'm kidding, but yeah.
The stay-behind groups were mostly funded by NATO. That's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. Although
off the
actually,
top of my head.
Tactically, this is my fault because I wrote the script. So, but actually, when these groups were begun, NATO did not quite yet exist.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, so they were, but eventually they came under the umbrella of NATO.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And they were organized and trained by MI6 and the CIA. Their activities were coordinated with NATO eventually, and they were under the control of the host country. In theory, anyway. In a few countries such as Sweden and Finland, the networks were set up without the knowledge of the government, ostensibly.
Yeah.
For example, Sweden was officially neutral, and the Swedish government claimed to know nothing about their stay-behind network until its existence was revealed in the 1990s.
Yeah, that's what they say. I mean, personally, I'm skeptical of that. I think they just wanted a little plausible deniability there.
That makes sense.
There was one Swedish stay-behind agent who said in the 1990s that their recruits had been vetted by the Swedish security services. So how could that be that the Swedish government had no clue, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, there was a CIA representative in Sweden in the 90s whose name was Paul Garbler, who said that the Swedish government was actually a direct participant in their Stay Behind Asian program.
Yeah, but you could also get why they wanted to be really on the DL about it. Because, like, I mean, I've been to Finland, and it's kind of crazy when you don't really think about how much border Finland shares with the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They have to Russia now. Yeah, they have to watch their steps very carefully. But, and I got to say, too, you just don't want to talk about this. There's, a network like this is not very useful if you talk about it. It's got to be a deeply guarded secret, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, otherwise, So, so there are other countries which claim to know nothing about Gladio. Let's see. There's Finland, of course, Spain and Austria. Again, those governments claim that they had no clue whatsoever. They had these secret networks.
Yeah.
Again, I'm taking these denials with a grain of salt, personally. Although, of course, they'd apply. And on the other hand, truthfully, most of the people within the governments of those countries could truthfully say they didn't know because they weren't supposed to know. It's just,
right.
Again, like I said, the existence of a secret spy network is supposed to be a very closely guarded secret.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
But that secret spilled. All secrets get spilled sooner or later, though, right?
Right, yeah.
In 1990, a Stay Behind Cash was found in Utrecht in the Netherlands.
The Netherlands.
It was discovered by a property owner buried in the basement of his building. It included 6 Browning HPs, which is a...
high powers.
High powers.
Yeah. That's what they call it. Sorry, no. Yeah, my bad. Yeah, the high power.
Not like HP chef sauce? That's
no, British. No, yeah. Yeah, the high powers. Okay. Yeah.
So that's a British-made suppressed pistol.
Mm-hmm.
Some explosives and several radios. Everyone assumed that this was a stash left by the Dutch resistance from World War II.
Yeah, and it was funny, too, because it was like across the street from a place that had been actually a German headquarters in World War II as well, part of the German occupation. So everybody's going like, oh my God, these guys were so ballsy. They had their little resistance HQ right across the street from the Germans.
But then some electronics aficionados noticed that the radios were too modern to be from World War II. And this is when the Stay Behind networks began to unravel.
Yeah, that's also in 1990, the Italian branch of the Stay Behind network was discovered. And this one, of course, was actually codenamed Gladio.
Right.
As we said earlier, and Italy is actually where most of the fireworks from these revelations took place. Mm. I mean, there was a lot. It was this thing was more controversial in Italy than in most of the other countries. But Italy had undergone some instability, like in the late 60s and the 70s, which might explain some of the reasons this was controversial. Yeah, and they were veering back that way back in like the late 60s and the 70s as well. So the Italian government acknowledged the existence of this network, but also said that such networks existed in every Western European country. True enough. Mm-hmm. The Italian Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, I think I said right. I don't know.
Giulio Andreotti.
Yeah, okay. Giulio Andreotti, okay. He said that there were 762 civilians in Gladio and 127 weapons caches.
Wow.
Which is, actually by the standards of the other countries of Europe, that's kind of a lot.
That number is really impressive.
It is, although I don't know if he was... I don't know if he was talking about everybody that was a member of Gladio at that moment or if he was talking about the people that had been in it over the course of the last 40 years or so. Yes. I'm not sure what he was talking about in that case, but probably the latter. But also he's been accused of understating the number of network members and leaving key names off, which maybe. I don't know. Again, every one of these organizations varied a bit in its character and its numbers from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So these accusations, though, they may not be entirely true. Gladio in Italy has been accused of being more than just a network of future spies. It's been accused of engaging in more proactive measures like combating subversion and communism.
Mm.
It's been claimed that explosives used in a car bombing in 1972 matched explosives found in one of the Gladio stashes.
Ooh.
It's also been said that other paramilitary anti-communist activity in Italy, including several bombings in the late 60s and 70s, were committed by groups affiliated with and funded by the Italian government with the participation of the U.S. and the CIA.
Yeah.
The CIA would never do something like that.
Oh, no, not at all. But
covertly in another state's affairs?
Mm. Well, actually, the CIA's got it. They actually have to go out and accomplish something once in a while. So, so this is a good way to do it. Now, these accusations may or may not be true, or maybe partially true. But, of course, if they are true, this doesn't prove that these paramilitary groups, and these paramilitary groups did exist. Like especially in Italy in the 70s and such.
Oh, definitely.
But, the question is, were they part of the government? Were they actually actively created by and funded by the government, or were they sort of private organizations? Or and of course, it's been said that they were part of Gladio as well, but there's really I've yet to see the proof of this. You know, other than there's that question about the explosives used in that car bombing, perhaps. But at the same time, I mean, of course, you know, Gladio and some of these paramilitary groups did share certain political affinities, like an aversion to communism.
Yeah, that's true.
There is that. But the question is you know, but the image, the popular image of Gladio, and again, I'm talking about European-wide, is of a bunch of, like, you know, ex-commando types. But, you know, is this image really accurate? And from all the hoo-ha, you would think that the average gladiator was a battle-hardened commando in his 20s to 30s and a few Bruce Willis types in their 40s calling the shots, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's the image in my head.
I know, it is. I mean, but is this really I think of movies like Ronin with De Niro, you know, and Jean Reno, you know, like that's the kind of thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
You know,
right,
and
right.
But is this really the profile of the kind of people who were actually recruited?
Well, maybe we could get a window into the thinking of the people who created the Stay Behind operations in Europe by looking at the Stay Behind program in America. There was one.
And actually, this one's a little bit better documented. There are some surviving records from this one.
So this one was called Operation Washtub.
Great name, by the way.
I love the name.
Yeah.
This program was only declassified in 2014. It was part of a joint effort between the FBI and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, a.k.a. OSI.
OSI, OSI, yeah, OSI, yeah.
The program was conceived in 1950 and was in operation between 1951 and 1959, right there at the heart of the Cold War.
Yeah, and who knows, maybe longer. Maybe they only pretended to phase it out in 59.
Right.
Yeah, so there's one FBI surviving memo describing the idea behind it. So, quote, the plan is to provide for an organization within Alaska designed to obtain, collect, and transmit such intelligence information as may be of value to the United States in the event that Alaska or a part thereof is invaded and occupied by armed forces of the enemy, unquote. The enemy, of course, being the Soviets.
Yeah, we're just talking about Alaska here, not Washington, D.C. or New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, your grandpa probably was not part of the secret network. You should probably ask him if he was, just in case.
You probably should. What the hell? Yeah.
At this time, Alaska was still a territory. It didn't become a state until 1959.
Yeah.
It used to be a Russian colony back in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And we bought it from them in 1867 for $7.2 million.
I think we overpaid, but no, just kidding. Actually, we got a deal. We got a deal. Although, you know, you could see the thinking, you know, considering those obstreperous Ruskies, you know, how they might jump back across the sea and say that, you know, they were hornswoggled and cheated, and rightfully Alaska belongs to them because they were there first and yada, 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 you know? So, hey.
Yes.
And again, Alaska was not yet a state. It was not a state. And was it vulnerable to invasion? Well, you better believe it was. Oh, yeah. In fact, it was invaded thousands of years ago by vast numbers of Siberians who just walked on over.
Yeah.
So, sea levels have risen since then, of course. And so it's underwater now, but yeah.
You can't walk to Russia anymore.
Yeah, unless you're Jesus, of course.
And it's worth noting, the Japanese held territory in Alaska for part of the Second World War.
They did.
Over a couple islands.
Yeah.
The Aleutian chain.
So yeah. But
this would be a...
Yeah, and so you can see why there'd be some people would be wondering if perhaps it would be worth guarding Alaska a little bit more carefully. Mm. I mean, hell, you know, I mean... In World War II, we had soldiers stationed at Fort Stevens, Oregon, at the mouth of the Columbia River. There's a whole fort there. We had these enormous batteries of gigantic artillery guns to shoot at Japanese ships if they would happen to show up. Yeah, never did. A few subs showed up and shelled it, but other than that, there was no action at Fort Stevens.
Yeah.
But
I'm getting a baseball field, if I recall.
So there was a little paranoia about Russia.
And I think American military strategists saw Alaska as a viable target for the Soviets because it would give them a lot of airstrips, a lot of business in Alaska is conducted via airplane because there's so much, you know, open space, and it can take so long and it's so difficult to cross.
A lot of flying going on there.
Much more than in the continental United States. So they could use the airstrips to raid on the West Coast.
drop nukes. Because remember, too, in the 50s, we did not yet, we hadn't fielded all of our vast ICBM forces, ballistic missiles I'm talking about here.
Right.
You'd
have to fly the bomb there.
Yeah, yeah.
Dr. Strangelove.
World War II style, you know, fly them in there and drop the big one, you know. And so that's why, you know, that's why denying them airstrips closer to the continental U.S. was, you know, considered to be a really good idea back then.
Right.
Of course, now, you know, with ICBMs and et cetera, it's not as important to, you know, keep those Soviet bombers. Well, we still want to keep them out, but yeah.
But, you know, back in the 50s, you know, they were keeping bombers up in the air basically round the clock.
I believe we still do have a practice of keeping a few bombers up there just in case. Part of the old nuclear triad. The other usefulness of Alaska to the Soviets would, of course, be to head off nuclear attack, because we had B-52s in the air over Alaska all the time back then.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're kind of close to Siberia, close to the pole. They could fly over the pole or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And drop a few nukes, and they were just basically turning circles over Alaska, waiting for the order on high to head into Russia and drop the big one.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Soviets controlled Alaska, then those bombers couldn't be loitering overhead all the time, could they? So that would be that would help to keep them safe from our bombs, our nukes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see why they thought that the thinking was that Alaska would be a really valuable target for the Soviets.
Yeah. And then you can think of that. You can think of why you would want to have a stay behind operation.
Hell yeah.
But the agents recruited for the stay behind program were known to have no ties to the military or any intelligence service.
Yeah, no, it was important. Yeah. To make sure these were low profile, non-military types, right?
I think this is really fascinating. So they were fishermen, they were bush pilots, trappers, things like that. Just kind of regular Alaskans from then. And they were positioned around strategic Alaskan towns such as Fairbanks, Kodiak, Anchorage, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was the government looking for with Operation Washtub? One FBI report had a profile of the ideal day behinder. Why don't you tell us about him?
Okay, here we go. Quote, "He is a professional photographer in Anchorage. He has only one arm, and it is felt that he would not benefit the enemy in any labor battalion. He is a pilot of small aircraft. He is reasonably intelligent, particularly crafty, and possessed of sufficient physical courage, as is indicated by his offer to guide a party which was to have hunted Kodiak bear, armed only with bow and arrow," unquote. This is great. I love their profile here. I'm not that impressed. You know, when I hunt Kodiak bears, I use a pocket knife.
If you can hunt bears with one arm and a bow and arrow, you've impressed me.
Well, you gotta use your teeth, man.
I'm impressed. That's all I'm trying to say.
I don't think that this profile described like just one person with all these attributes. At least I hope not. I mean, you know, seriously.
You'd have to go back and reread that a few times. He's a photographer. He hunts bears. He's got
one arm and he can fly an airplane. Yeah.
What? I got a little thrown off.
I think, too, they were looking for guys, besides people that didn't have military experiences, they were looking for the kind of individual rebellious type, you know, who would, if the Russians asked him, they say, "Well, do you love the United States government?" And he would say, "Hell no, I don't love the government. That's why I'm up here in Alaska to begin with." You know, so that's the kind of, that's the kind of character they were seeking out.
Right. But you got to note the main thing that they were not looking for in their ideal candidate,
mm-hmm.
military service. They seem to want to avoid vets, men with military service histories, which would obviously arouse suspicion with these Soviet occupiers.
Yeah. And they also seem to avoid men of military age in general. They screened thousands of candidates for this program in Alaska, and they wound up recruiting reportedly 89 men into the program. The average age of their recruits was 50 years old. So, they stayed away from the military age guys. So they seem to want Grizzly Adams types, you know, grizzled he-men, or excuse me, he-persons, who could disappear into the wilderness for a year and be just fine. That wouldn't be me. I'd disappear into the wilderness and I'd be dead in 48 hours. If I held out that long, I don't know. Bugs alone would probably kill me.
Oh, God. Yeah. The successful recruits were flown to Seattle for training in airdrop and pickup techniques, scouting, patrolling, map reading, Arctic survival, secret ink, and photography.
Nice. Sneaky photography.
The military also built stashes for weapons and gear all over the place.
Yeah, just like in Europe, right?
Yeah, it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
Initial plans called for 100 of these supply outposts to be built, but the ultimate number is to this day unknown.
Mm-hmm.
At least not to us. I'm sure there might be somebody out there who knows. Each cache held 30-06 rifles with scope, probably like an M1 Garand.
Yeah, remember those? Well, the good old Garand from World War II.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, classic gun.
$500 in gold.
Nice, yeah.
Explosives to demo the cache if it looked like it was going to fall into enemy hands.
Probably more explosives than that. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, probably. It's a little more than that. Enough explosives. To do some real damage, though, I think is the takeaway.
Yeah.
There was also other survival gear like climbing rope, crampons, parka, mukluks, gloves, fur caps, snowshoes, skis, ski boots, poles, wax, portable stove, sleeping bag, and a Mae West life jacket. $1,000 of gasoline.
Yeah, I love it.
Maps, compasses, flashlights, signaling mirrors. I mean, they had the whole thing.
Yeah, plus also I'm assuming some food.
I would imagine.
You would think, yeah.
Depending on where the stash was, there also might be a canoe or like dog sled equipment, or maybe even an outboard motor.
Okay, that explains the Mae West life jacket then. Okay, I was a little mystified there. maybe there, the idea was that you would inflate it and sit on it and just surf down the side of a mountain in the snow. But that'd be kind of fun, actually.
Yeah.
But one thing is missing from this was booze. I suppose you were expected to bring your own. That's kind of... cheap on the part of the government, right?
All right.
One responsibility of these stay-behind agents would be to facilitate mass escapes of American civilians from occupied areas. Another would be to be on the lookout for American pilots who'd been shot down in combat and needed rescue. And, of course, another was just to gather intelligence, take covert photos of Soviet air bases, that kind of thing, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was expected they might need to stay in the wilderness for a long while. So these caches had plenty of supplies, enough to sustain a man for an entire year, supposedly. Yeah. So anyway, that is essentially, that's Operation Washtub. They recruited a bunch of, interesting Alaskan types and, gave them lots of gear, gave them training. And I think they were given a salary of like between $2,500 and $3,000 a year.
Probably not so bad for that time up there.
Yeah, not at all. Not so bad at all. Unfortunately for them, the whole thing came to an end in 1959, at least on paper.
Mm.
Alas, yeah. I guess they decided that, again, probably the advent of things like ICBMs really made Alaska seem like not such an inviting target for the Soviets after all.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So the caches were turned into survival stores for downed aircraft and the crews thereof, at least. And other people who might be in trouble in the wilderness. I assume that the guns and the gold and the explosives were removed by the military, if they hadn't already been stolen, of course. But by 1961, these caches were abandoned entirely because actually they were kind of difficult to maintain. They were out in the middle of nowhere and usually in rough areas. So they were just kind of tough to maintain. And on top of that, the supplies in them apparently were constantly being looted by the locals.
Yeah, I could see that happening.
Yeah, once the word's out, and you know that there's all kinds of goodies in there, you'd want to go nab some of that for yourself, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's where it ended up.
Now,
we're going to get back to Operation Gladio. But first, I think we should be talking about our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. Listen in. Sponsors. Listen. Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. All right. Well, so Operation Washtub, that was it. So the reason we took this little detour into Alaskan history, besides the fact that it's a really fun story, at least I think it's kind of fun, is I think it provides a little insight into who would be recruited into any stay-behind program.
Yeah, I think that is instructive.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that Washtub was a carbon copy of the European stay-behind operations. One thing I'm sure the Europeans didn't seek out any one-armed bow hunters. Probably aren't any of those in Europe.
How do you know? There could be one.
Yeah, actually, there probably are. But Europe's got some rugged areas filled with rugged, grizzled he-men, just like Alaska. So that's probably true.
Why not? Yeah.
Yeah.
But the idea that they should recruit people who wouldn't stand out as resistance types seems like pretty obvious.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The the popular conception is that they would all just be guys like the cast of Ronin.
I know, right? What's that, by the way? You've all seen the movie, right? Ronin?
Yeah, with Robert De Niro?
Right, yeah, De Niro and Jean Reno and Sean Bean was in it. And a few other He-Man types. And these are all like, you know, seasoned military types who come together for a big heist or something. I can't remember.
That's a great movie.
It actually is a pretty good movie. But, you know, that seems to be the way most people see it, as being people like that, you know, really.
Yeah. But you got to wonder if people's perceptions of it were influenced by Hollywood.
Yeah.
How many, you know, movies you've seen in which you've got some, you know, crack force of special commando types. They get back together. They're going to, you know, pull off a heist or stop a terrorist act or commit a terrorist act or help overthrow the government or whatever.
Yeah.
Exactly. You see this stuff. Very Chuck Norris. But. Mm-hmm. The theories behind Operation Gladio, they seem a little too good to be true to me.
Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, like when I first heard about Operation Gladio, I was a lot less skeptical than I am after hearing more about it.
Yeah. But, and I am too. I'm skeptical about some of the more lurid stories about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, the story does read just a bit too much like a Hollywood script. And, you know, the whole idea too, again, this is, in Hollywood, a group like this, some sort of underground paramilitary or intelligence group or whatever, they are always in the Hollywood script going to stray, and they're gonna like be corrupted, and they're gonna, you know, go off and do evil things for, you know, which they were not originally intended for.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, in real life, it's not necessarily a given.
Not necessarily.
I'm just saying that, yeah. You know, yeah, but once again, it's just like hard for people to comprehend a bunch of people like this just sitting around for decades and not saying, hey, let's use our special skills to, you know, go do something evil. You know, I mean, right?
Right, exactly. It's
just, yeah, but in fact, in real life, I think it probably is true that these people did just sit around and collect their small stipend and, you know, and do nothing for decades until the government finally told them their services would no longer be needed.
There is a thing called mission creep, right?
Oh, yeah. Always.
You know, this always. And so you can imagine that, you know, there are a bunch of guys sitting around waiting for the communists to invade. And 20 something years later, they still ain't done it.
Well, probably. And yeah. Like,
well, maybe we could put them on, you know, going after these communist students or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's true. Especially at a place like Italy, which is seeing a lot of turmoil. You could picture some of these people might, like you say, just decide, you know, hey, we got some weapons. We got the organization and we got the secrets. Let's do it. Yeah. But, or, you know, another possibility, too, is that none of the Gladio groups in Italy actually had any part with any of these paramilitary operations in Italy. But perhaps they were connected to the government, which a lot of us suspect was the case. And let's say there's somebody high up in the Italian government that's helping to organize these paramilitary groups, right? Who also happens to be briefed in on Gladio. And who knows that there are 127 stashes of weapons and explosives in Italy. And so as paramilitary buddies, you might just clue them in where a few of these things are so they could go and raid them and get themselves some explosives and guns.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's sort of Gladio related, but actually maybe nobody actually in the Gladio program actually had any part of this. They just had some of their stuff taken from them. Again, that's just purely a hypothetical. I don't know. But, and it's also another hypothetical is that the actual connection between the explosives used in that car bomb, for example, and the Gladio cache they supposedly came from, that connection didn't actually happen, and somebody either made a mistake or dummied up the evidence. Because that's the other thing too, is like, you know, if you're in, say, the Italian government and it's looking like you've got some paramilitary groups out there that were, you know, operating under the radar doing some illegal things, you might want to, instead of having it be a paramilitary group that you created and organized and funded yourself, you might want to have it be this sort of NATO-funded, CIA-backed group operating on your territory instead, because that sort of diffuses the responsibility away from you and outward a little bit.
That makes sense.
You know what I mean? That, yeah, it kind of does. Yeah. But again, we're not here to explain everything that happened in Italian politics in the 1970s. Just asking, you know, how much of a part in this did these stay behind networks really play in some of this stuff?
Yeah, it's odd. It's really complicated.
Yeah, and again, because it's hard to say. The records have been burned, basically. I don't know.
And what that's ended up with is with Operation Gladio being becoming sort of a, at some point I will definitely do a multi-parter about the, what they call the Brabant killers. They were these criminals, and some people think that they were part of a former cell of a stay behind type.
Operation
Gladio gets brought up. I don't find there to be a lot of evidence for it.
No, there's zero evidence, actually. And I mean, I actually made that connection myself at one time in the past. We've talked about this in the past. Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I've it occurred to me that, you know, that these guys might be a Gladio branch gone astray.
Yeah.
But now that I've got done a little more research into the stay behind networks, I realize that maybe not so likely. Still possible.
Still
but again,
possible.
When I first heard about Gladio, I was thinking about these guys being kind of, like I said, like the cast of Ronin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rather than just a bunch of 50-year-old guys who receive training. Yeah. Who received some training in, operating a radio and secret ink and, surreptitious photography rather than, you know, how to use a submachine gun and throw a grenade. So, so I'm less convinced about the Brabant killers head. I mean, the thing about it is, too, is like in America, in Europe, everywhere, there's millions of guys out there with military experience. Mm-hmm. And so any one of those guys who might have known each other from the service could get back together in civilian life, you know, and, you know, go rob banks and, you know, stuff like that, like the Brabant killers did.
Yeah.
So
it happens.
Yeah, it happens.
We've known of it happening here in the United States. That was one of the theories that has been put forward about the burrowing bandits of L.A.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Some guys, that's true. They did have a certain amount of discipline to accomplish that little feat, didn't they?
Right. And that doesn't mean that they were part of some kind of, you know, stay behind sleeper cell.
No.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, the odds are with the Brabant killers is that they probably were in the military, but odds are they were not any part of any stay behind network.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So
when you're out there and you're learning about conspiracies around Operation Gladio, use a suspicious lens, but know that it is a real thing. It really did happen. We just don't know all of the ins and outs of how and who and everything else, because the records were mysteriously destroyed. Well,
that's
really obviously why they did that.
Yeah, no, there's probably a good reason to do that, but it's fueled a lot of conspiracy theories, and a lot of them are fun. I will be the first to admit. But are they really true? I don't know. Yeah,
hard to say.
But anyway, that's about it for this. This is kind of a short episode. Sorry about that, because
we'll catch up with some long stuff next week.
Oh yeah, we totally will. I mean, the thing about it is as you and I were talking about before we started recording, this is a real rabbit hole. I mean, you could.
Oh yeah.
There's a lot of stuff out there about Gladio. The reason that we left so much of it out, besides time considerations, is that there's massive quantities of stuff, and it's impossible to say what's true and what is just, you know, just straight out BS conspiracy theorizing. It's just impossible to say. And of course, especially when some of the governments involved are unwilling to talk about it at all.
Yeah.
Former participants don't want to talk about it. You know, they've all kept the secrets for them almost entirely, at least. A few of them have spoken up, but, you know, mm-hmm. for the most part. And so it's really hard to say what's true and what's not. So I'm going to go for it's probably all BS. But
I'm going to go for it's probably all true, and they're behind everything.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. I like that one. Yeah, they're lizard people. All right. Well, anyway, so that is sadly the end of this episode. Like I said, a brief one. And probably a few of you are going to be, if you happen to know a little bit about Gladio and you're obsessed about it, you'll be angry with us. You're going to want to shoot us an angry email, right?
Well, yeah, that's what people like to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So please do. Yeah. But
okay. Let's turn this into a positive.
Yeah.
Please find us on social media, on Twitter or Facebook, preferably, and tell us what theory, what instance, what conspiracy, whatever it is that you connect with Operation Gladio.
And yeah.
I think Operation Gladio may have had some hand in, because I'll bet there's some good ones out there I'm not even aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm sure there are. And so, if you stay tuned, also, you can hear the lovely Tess tell you our email address, because we're too lazy to tell you ourselves. And, of course, lastly, we want to beg you, if you haven't already, to leave us a nice rating and a review, wherever you might get your episode from.
Yeah.
So, please. Yeah.
All right. Well, and we'll catch you next week.
I guess that's about it. So, until next week, au revoir.
Ciao.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
We're left stranded in and around. Didn't even feel it coming on. Snap.
Oh, damn it.
In the wake of the occupation, and invasion.
Yeah, you got that kind of backwards there. Yeah,
I gotta say that right.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.